Hello everyone, hope you had a good lunch. Okay, skin. It's 1960, I'm a young black woman on her way to a party in a university town in New York State. When I get there, I find there's a brown paper bag nailed to the door. I know exactly what it is. I take the bag and I measure it against my skin. If I'm lighter than the brown bag, I can come in. If I'm darker, I can't. The thing is, this front door belongs to a black family. It belongs to the black, middle class, aspirational, ambitious, educated black community. And they're willing to do anything to get on, including exclude darker skinned black people from their social circle. So I moved to New Orleans and I looked for the black community there, very closely associated with the church. I get up on Sunday morning, I get dressed, and I go to church, and I get to the door, and the pastor's there. And he performs the blue vein test. I must hold up my arm, and if he can see my blue veins through my black skin, I can come in. And if he can't, I can't. Elsewhere in America, you will find the comb test, where you would go to an event, and before you get in, they put a comb through your hair. Does it snag? Are your curls too tight? If so, you can't come in. All of this slide, it says here on my notes, this is colorism. And it's not something we talk about in the black community. It's something we're ashamed of. It's something we barely acknowledge because we like to know where discrimination is coming from. We like to know the face of our enemy, and the face of our enemy is usually white, but not always. Sometimes colorism comes from ourselves. Discrimination based on skin tone exists all over the world. In India, very, very prevalent in Africa, in the Philippines, in South America. But the colorism I want to talk to that affects my community, African Caribbean community, and the States, comes very unsurprisingly from the transatlantic slave trade. Black people first arrived in the Caribbean and the Americas from Africa and were immediately put to work. That's what they were there for. They were there to work on the plantations. It was hard, outdoor work in the burning sun, men, women, and children. And at the end of a long day, black women were raped routinely by white overseers and by their plantation owners, which obviously resulted in children. And the plantation owners saw this not only as a pleasurable activity for them, but a way of increasing their stock. But those children were mixed race. And they were considered easier on the European eye. And so they would be given jobs in the houses and in the kitchen garden, and their lives became easier. And of course, the mixed race woman that were put to work in the house would be raped again, and they'd have children again. And that would go on and on until some of those children actually looked very white indeed, very like the overseer's legitimate children. And occasionally, the overseers would acknowledge those children in a way. Not fully, but they might educate their sons. They might dress their daughters well. And on sometimes these women would be put in their own house with their children and with their own servants. And so what you would have is the field slaves, the enslaved people that were working in the fields would look at those lighter skinned brown people and think, wow, that's a better life. They saw the relative ease and privilege compared to themselves, toiling away, picking cotton, cutting sugar cane, back-breaking, cruel work, 16 to 18 hours. On average, each black enslaved person lived 15 years from capture to death. In the big house, however, better food, shelter, less beatings. In fact, it doesn't mean you didn't get sold, by the way. It just meant your life might be easier, but you could still be sold because you got a better price for a light-skinned woman than you would for a black woman. But it did mean you had an easier life, you had a longer life, and you might avoid being beaten to death for not working hard enough. No wonder lighter skin was something to be desired. But no matter how light your skin, in the Americas, the one drop rule still applied. That rule states that if you have one drop of black blood, you're black. They consider the idea of a white-skinned black person so subversive, so dangerous, so uncomfortable, that they had to find a way to codify blackness. The census of 1790 clearly indicated that there were black people and there were white people. There were just the two groups. But with the mixing of blacks and whites, it was necessary to introduce stratification to codify the difference between shades of black skin. So as time went on, subsequent censuses began, is it censuses or censi? Anyway, began to look like this. On the one side, white, unchangeable, pure, simple, the preferred state. But on the other side, gradations of blackness. So initially there were slaves, then there were slaves and coloured persons, then there were blacks and mulattoes. Mulattoes is one black person, one black parent, one white parent, from the word for mule. Then came quadroons, quadroon, one quarter black. Then came octoroon, one eighth black. Octoroon women were especially prized. All that European peachy skin, and under it, in their opinion, the wild, untamed black African woman. They thought it was the best combination. They were very routinely sold as sex objects, and sometimes they ended up as mistresses. And I say mistresses, they had no choice about it. So they weren't really mistresses. They were still enslaved people and still somebody's property. By 1920, the census was, they just thought, this is a ridiculous situation. Where do we go from octoroon? I don't know what the word would be for 1/16th and 1/24th, but they realised that that kind of codifying was unsustainable. So they just decided to use the word Negro for everybody. White-skinned black people, black-skinned black people, they were all Negroes. If you're black, if you had any black parent, just tick the box that says Negro. You'd think that was ancient history, wouldn't you? Except in 1985, which to me is just the other day, a Louisiana court ruled that a woman with a black great-great-great-grandmother could not identify herself as white on her passport. 1985. It's alive and kicking. Thus, a hierarchy of blackness was created and colorism was created. Not just white people grading black people by the color of their skin, but black people aching for a better life of the light-skinned enslaved person, witnessing the vastly improved life chances, better housing, employment prospects, and even the length of your life was all based on the exact shade of your skin. The lighter your skin, the closer your proximity to high social standing, privilege, and opportunity. Blacks were therefore set against each other. Field worker versus house slave versus concubine, illiterate versus educated, alive versus dead. The ideology of white beauty standards, the white aesthetic, and white skin as highly desirous became deeply embedded in our psyche. But that's years ago, isn't it? Years ago. And it's in America, so it doesn't really apply. However, recent research shows that black people across the world with lighter skin can have up to 23% better employment prospects. They are paid more than dark-skinned people when they do get a job. They have an easier route through the education system and the justice system, and they're more likely to get married. That's what the research says. I don't see that as a positive myself, but that's what the research said. There is evidence from recent UK research that says heterosexual black men practice colorism in their preference for a white partner because of the perceived advantage for both them and their children. And then there's this staggering statistic. African Americans have an overall 36% chance of going to jail at some point in their life. Dark-skinned African Americans, meanwhile, have a near 66% chance of going to jail at some point during their life. I find that staggering, 30% increase based on the shade of your skin. And we know that where America leads, the UK is not far behind. And I speak as an ex-magistrate who spent 15 years before that in criminal law. And I've got the references for all of that research if anyone's interested. Skin shade, therefore, operates as a form of social capital that can determine a person's life chances, given that people with light skin just have it easier than people with black skin. They're more intelligent, more trustworthy, and more attractive than people with dark skin. And this gives rise to a very aggressive response, what I call a form of self-hatred, and that's skin bleaching. The skin bleaching industry is worth £7 billion, and it grows at the rate of 7% per year. In the UK, it's a booming industry. Creams and injections that use mercury, hydroquinone and steroids to lighten the skin, ingredients which are extremely dangerous and can cause skin thinning, mercury poisoning, high blood pressure, dermatitis, kidney failure, and worst of all for people that take it, it can darken your skin into a blue-black pigment. Despite worldwide bans on many products, they are still easily available under the counter. It would take me about 15 minutes to go to the right shop and end up with a tube of Fair and Lovely skin lightening cream, which is banned in this country and many countries. So colorism was and is a way of dividing black people up into groups and turning us against one another. A divide and rule strategy as old as time that is still working very, very well today, as we know. Rather than us turn on the creators of the abominable system, we turn on one another, and therefore we turn on ourselves. Things are changing. There are movements to address colorism in the black community to build pride, confidence, and resilience in black children of all shades, especially those who suffer the brunt of racism and discrimination. Whilst the tastemakers of Hollywood and the media continue to cast light-skinned black women over dark-skinned black women, from the Fresh Prince of Bel-Air to Bridgerton, demonstrating their continued fascination with the octoroon. Darker black actors are, though, beginning to get noticed, and I'm talking here particularly about women, making their own films with all shades of brown skin and black skin on show. Those of us with light-skinned privilege, and when I say privilege, I mean unearned advantage, which I think is a better phrase than privilege. So those of us with light-skinned advantage owe it to our communities to acknowledge their experience, which is a different version of racism and exclusion to the one we suffer. And sometimes acknowledging your privilege is all you can do. It still matters. What else can we do? If we are white, acknowledging the continued role of slavery on black people in the here and now. Colonialism is alive and kicking. Be aware of practicing colorism in our social circle if we're hiring and firing. If we are doctors, nurses, teachers, social workers, be aware of your bias towards very black, dark skin. Think twice about your response to very black, dark skin. That so much hatred, division, and pain can be caused by something as arbitrary as different shades of skin colour is both fascinating and terrible. But we live in hope that it will not persist. These are my children. As Martin Luther King said, one day I dream that they will live in a world where they are judged not on their skin colour, but by the content of their character. Thank you.